From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
The shooting death of a black teen has sparked state and federal investigations, stirred accusations of racism, and brought attention to a law that critics say gives a person the right to shoot.
If anybody had the right to stand their ground, it would have been Trayvon Martin in this case.
The Florida Senate agrees on a redistricting plan.
A plan sensible to our constituents, understandable to all the members of the Senate, and faithful to the Constitution.
And lawmakers say the school prayer bill is all about religious tolerance. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. The shooting death of a 17-year-old teen has drawn national attention to the Central Florida community of Sanford. Trayvon Martin was killed in February by a self-appointed neighborhood watchman. Now Lynn Hatter reports, state and federal officials are looking for answers and the nation is having a conversation about race, profiling, and a Florida law that critics say is at the center of the case.
It starts with a phone call.
This guy looks like he's up to no good or he's on drugs or something. It's raining and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
It's a rainy day in February as 28-year-old George Zimmerman patrols his housing community, The Retreat at Twin Lakes in Sanford, Florida. It's a suburb about 20 minutes from Orlando. As Zimmerman keeps watch, he spots someone who looks out of place. He shares his growing alarm with the local 911 dispatcher.
Yeah, he's coming to check me out. He's got something in his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
He's got an officer over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. These assholes, they always get away.
Only minutes after this call, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin is dead, killed by a gunshot wound to the chest. He was carrying Skittles and iced tea. A month after the shooting, the Sanford police have not arrested Zimmerman, and he has not been charged with a crime. Zimmerman says he shot in self-defense.
My baby brother turned 17 2 weeks ago. If that would have happened here in Leon County, I would have took justice in my own hands. They would have to kill me.
The case has sparked protests across the country like this one in Tallahassee, with all asking a similar question. How can Zimmerman claim self-defense for shooting an unarmed teenager? At the center of the dispute is Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which allows people to use force to defend themselves if they're under attack. Zimmerman says he was, but the 911 calls seem to tell a different story.
He's running.
He's running. Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
All right, sir, what is your name?
George. He ran.
All right, George, what's your last name?
Zimmerman.
The recording suggests Zimmerman pursues Martin as the teen tries to run away, and despite the operator telling him not to. The law's sponsor, Republican Representative Dennis Baxley, says the law was meant to let people defend themselves if they're in danger of serious bodily harm or death. He criticizes the way the law has been interpreted, saying it was never meant to cover a person who acts as an aggressor.
The problem is not the Castle Doctrine. The problem is you've got a situation where a person is pursuing and confronting, and there's nothing in the statute that provides for that.
Since Florida passed Stand Your Ground, the number of justifiable homicides has increased. But criminal defense attorney Craig Brown says the law doesn't apply in the Trayvon Martin case. He says Zimmerman can try to claim self-defense, but he can't claim it under Florida's Stand Your Ground law.
That is not what Stand Your Ground is about. Stand Your Ground needs to be heard before a judge, but before you get there, an arrest should have been made. So here we're skipping part of the process. He created any risk of harm. If anybody had the right to stand their ground, it would have been Trayvon Martin in this
Absolutely.
Case.
But even Governor Rick Scott says the law deserves a second look.
It's an unfair law, but I think every time we see something like that, we have to review and make sure we're not giving people the opportunity to use a law that unfairly. Because we don't, look, nobody wants something to happen a young man like that.
Are you with me?
Yes.
Are you with me?
Yes.
No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
The case has been shrouded in allegations of racism and discrimination. For weeks, pressure has been building on the Sanford police and the state attorney's office for Zimmerman to be charged. The relationship between the city's law enforcement and the community is strained. State Senator Gary Siplin, an Orlando Democrat, says racial tension is not new to Sanford.
In terms of the vestiges of Sanford, you're absolutely right. The police has a history of stopping black folks and taking their fingerprints, okay, searching their cars without permission. You either let them take your fingerprints or they threaten to take you to jail.
The delayed action by Sanford's police department and the state attorney's office has prompted a federal investigation into whether their response, or lack thereof, constitutes a civil rights violation. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement has now gotten involved, and a grand jury will meet in April to determine whether there's enough evidence to charge Zimmerman with a crime. Siplin has been pushing for an independent prosecutor.
In an effort to make sure that this trial, when it does occur, that everything is above board.
Governor Rick Scott has appointed a new prosecutor and named a task force to study the Stand Your Ground law. The Sanford City Commission has issued a vote of no confidence in its police chief, and he has temporarily stepped down. A bipartisan coalition of state lawmakers say they're going on a fact-finding mission to Sanford to investigate the claims of racism. And Trayvon Martin's family says they'll continue to keep on the pressure until there's some action in the case. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The redistricting debate now moves to the Florida House. The Republican-dominated Florida Senate passed a revised map of Senate districts designed to fix constitutional flaws identified by the Supreme Court. However, James Call reports there are Democrats who say the plan still violates new anti-gerrymandering standards.
The Supreme Court invalidated the first map, saying it did not adhere to the rules voters added to the Constitution in 2010. Justices flagged eight districts with what they called objective indicators of improper intent. The court also rejected a numbering system they said favored incumbents and asked lawmakers to reconsider the decision to split the city of Lakeland into two districts. Senate President Don Gates of Niceville led the effort to fix the problems the justices identified.
So let us send our work now to our partners in the House of Representatives, a plan sensible to our constituents, understandable to all the members of the Senate, and faithful to the Constitution.
Revising the eight districts cited by the court produced a rippling effect, changing a total of 24 districts. The original plan avoided pitting any incumbents against each other. The new plan doubles up two pairs of senators. It places Republican Ellen Bogdanoff of Fort Lauderdale and Democrat Maria Sachs of Boca Raton in the same district. In Central Florida, Maitland Republican David Simmons says he will move to an open district to avoid facing off with Orlando's Andy Gardner, the majority leader. Democrats say the map still contains evidence of improper intent. Democratic leader Senator Nan Rich says, despite being given a roadmap by the court, senators ignored the directions and continue to violate the Constitution.
First, incumbent protection is written all over the map. As was mentioned by my colleague, Senator Joyner, District 13 still has issues with regard to an appendage whose only purpose can be to favor an incumbent and maintain a safe Republican seat. Districts 8 and 10 were drawn to give an incumbent House member an easier road to election.
The incumbent Rich refers to as Gardner, who is in line to be Senate president after Gates. Gates disputes the accusations, noting most of the redesigned district Gardner would seek to represent is in Brevard County and contains voters Gardner has never represented. Gates also objects to the use of appendage to describe legislative districts.
At some point, my friends, we need to remember that the term appendage can be a pejorative term. The fact is, these are human beings, 160,000+ people who live in Edgewood, Belle Isle, Conway, Winter Park, and Maitland. They live in a collection of communities that are legitimate, that aren't the function or the invention of map makers. They are there. They live there. That's their home. Those are their towns. It's not true that the district benefits an incumbent. The fact is that the district has been radically changed.
Redistricting every 10 years is the realignment of congressional and legislative districts to reflect changes in population. The maps are subject to federal approval under the Voting Rights Act. It is the most political of acts, with politicians drawing the districts for which many of the same politicians will compete to represent. Accusations that the interests of a community are second to the ambitions of politicians are common. Here, Lakeland Senator Paula Dockery, a term-limited Republican, speaks against an amendment affecting the division of Polk County that critics say benefits the Republican majority.
And I understand that people in here want to help their friends, some of the House members, to come over here. But that should be not be done on the backs of citizens of Polk County.
Senators approved the amendment and the new map. It now goes to the House. The chambers have an agreement to let each draw its own map. However, six Senate Democrats voted against the plan, and Miami Republican Senator Miguel de la Portilla failed in an attempt to create an additional South Florida Hispanic access seat. House Democratic leader Ron Saunders represents the Keys and is considering a Senate run. Saunders deflected questions when asked if he thinks the Senate plan will pass through the House without any amendments.
I know there's a gentleman's agreement, but in this process, not everybody's a gentleman or a lady.
The House has floor sessions scheduled Tuesday and Wednesday. Lawmakers have until the end of Wednesday to reach an agreement. Once they do, the Attorney General will have 15 days to transmit the proposed map to the Supreme Court. The justices will then have 30 days to review it. If the court rejects the plan, then the justices will have to draw a new map of Senate districts. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers say a bill that would allow public school prayer will teach students to tolerate the beliefs of others.
If we teach a kid how to read, write, and arithmetic, which is a part of the learning process and becoming a whole person, we ought to also teach them about morality and inspiration.
A mother is urging the governor not to veto an item in the state's health care budget that she says could go a long way in saving babies born without an immune system.
Just knowing that somebody else's child didn't have to go through this, another mother or father didn't have to go through seeing their son in the hospital every day, it would mean the world.
And there may be cutbacks on the way for Florida's minority health programs.
Probably been in a bad way, and we probably would not be even doing this interview because diabetes is really serious.
Money for minority health programs is one of the items Governor Scott has to decide whether to keep in this year's budget. And as Jessica Palumbo of member station WJCT in Jacksonville reports, the money could save some programs from having to close their doors.
55-year-old Ron Dozier lives in Jacksonville. In March of last year, he attended a free diabetes screening given by the Duval County Health Department.
And they told me to go to the hospital immediately because my blood sugar was 371.
Once he had been diagnosed with diabetes, Dozier went to county workshops that taught him about portion control and how to shop for groceries. Then he returned for regular health checkups that showed his blood sugar, cholesterol, and weight improving over time. He says it scares him to think where he might be today without the program.
So I would probably have been in a bad way, and we probably would not be even doing this interview because diabetes is really serious.
But the county program that helped him, and about 1,400 other people last year, faces an uncertain future. Juana Brown of the Duval Health Department says 100% of the program's budget comes from state grant money. But those funds will run out at the end of June.
We're not going to be able to continue unless we get funding from another source. But as of, you know, like I said, we haven't been able to secure funding yet. So, I mean, June 30th is around the corner.
But Brown says her hope is renewed by the $3.1 million set aside for minority health initiatives in the Florida budget. If Governor Scott approves that money, programs like hers will be able to compete for pieces of it. State Representative Mia Jones, a Jacksonville Democrat, was on the budget committee, and she says she fought to get the money added back into the budget because health education is so important.
Oftentimes you find persons within the minority community having to work multiple jobs in order just to make ends meet, and so they will then end up in a situation where, you know, okay, I didn't get to the doctor, or I know I was supposed to go to that specialist, and I just didn't get there.
Jones says the problem can be compounded by lack of doctors in a community, no good transportation, and general lack of role models who know the best health practices. She says that's why Florida's minorities have relatively high rates of death, infant mortality, and other diseases compared with whites. Ron Dozier, who credits a state-funded program for his healthy lifestyle, says he sympathizes with the governor as he shapes the budget.
I'm really a person that believes in limited government and that the community need to help more than ever before. But I say some programs that are helping people, they can't afford to help themselves.
Governor Scott has received the budget and must decide how to act on it within 15 days. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
A state budget item that would allow newborns to get screened for a certain disease is now in Governor Rick Scott's hands. As Sasha Cordner reports, if Scott does not veto the health care budget item, proponents say it would give babies born without a normal immune system a chance for a normal life.
Whoa. You okay?
22-month-old Kai Johnson is playing with his mother, Alethea Arthur. He's your typical infant, getting into things and playing with toys and a bag of crayons. But there's one thing that separates him from your average healthy baby.
He's born without a working immune system.
At birth, Kai was born with bubble boy disease due to a genetic defect. Its actual name is severe combined immunodeficiency disease, or SCID. Arthur says when her son was only a year old, he was finally diagnosed with the disease. But because she didn't know about it before that, he was exposed to a lot of infections that were killing him.
Really, it's just their inability to not fight off infections. And a lot of doctors shove it off to something else like pneumonia, bronchitis, a cold.
Kai is currently at All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg, where he's been for about 10 months, seven of those months in isolation. If he had been diagnosed within the first 3 months of his birth, he would have had a better chance of getting treated. But not being diagnosed for many months after that lowered his chances of survival. Dr. John Sleesman, one of Kai's doctors, says it's normal for doctors not to be able to diagnose the disease right away, leading many kids to die at a young age.
Universally, all these children die usually before the age of two if they're not treated with a stem cell, what we call bone marrow transplant.
Kai already underwent a bone marrow transplant in January, but Sleesman says because the disease was not caught early enough, Kai may need to undergo another bone marrow transplant and his condition is tenuous. Sleesman says to avoid a misdiagnosis, it would be to every newborn's benefit to get screened for SCID, in addition to 30 other tests babies get at birth.
The test that's done is a very simple and inexpensive test, and it can be done on a single drop of blood.
He says not doing the screening costs the state millions of dollars to treat a child who may still end up dying. In Kai's case, the cost for his care so far is $3 million, and Medicaid foots the bill.
And so to spend that amount of money and still have the heartbreak for the family of potentially losing a child is something that to me is unacceptable.
Republican Representative Matt Hudson is the man responsible for putting the newborn screening of SCID in the health care budget, which is now in the governor's hands. Legislation for the actual screening hadn't gone anywhere earlier in the session, so as the Florida House health care budget writer, Hudson put it in the budget. Hudson says it's important because it saves lives.
So with proper diagnosis and knowing up front, a child can go through a bone marrow transplant at a far lesser cost of about $80,000 to $100,000 and ultimately survive, which is the most important thing. Forget any money. The child's survival is at stake. And the welfare of that family is maintained.
Arthur says she's hopeful her son can be released from the hospital soon, and she knows she has a tough journey ahead of her. At Kai's release, she'll have to find a new home for him without carpet, and he won't be able to eat foods like fruits and vegetables for a while. Arthur says it would mean a lot if Governor Rick Scott does not veto the budget item.
Just knowing that somebody else's child didn't have to go through this, another mother or father didn't have to go through seeing their son in the hospital every day, it would mean the world.
Governor Scott vetoed a similar measure last year, but Representative Hudson says he's been in talks with the governor's office and there has been every indication that Scott won't do that this year because he's more well-informed about the issue. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Dr. Stephanie Haridopoulos of Brevard County often asks her patients if they've been victims of domestic violence. As Jill Roberts from member station WQCS in Fort Pierce tells us, that's because of her own past.
And, oh, yes. See, what she learns from you. That's what you got to learn from being a big sister.
Dr. Stephanie Haridopoulos spends time reading to two little girls at the Safe Space Shelter in Vero Beach. They beam as she compliments them, and she smiles back, a radiant smile that lights up a pretty face framed with shoulder-length blonde hair. If she were reading a Disney book, she could easily be mistaken for a princess in its pages. And she admits she feels she has a charmed life. She's married to Senate President Mike Haridopoulos and has three children. But her life was once very different, and we want to emphasize that that part of her life occurred before her marriage to the senator.
I'd wake up to a pillow smothering me in the morning.
Haridopoulos is the final interview we'll bring you this week in our series on domestic violence. It's something she went through for 7 years.
And not sure if you'd let go of the pillow so I can breathe again. So sometimes it was, you know, living for me is a huge victory, and I savor every day that I'm alive.
A woman of strong faith, Haridopoulos says she doesn't want to encourage divorce, but knows there are times it's inevitable.
The last event was quite traumatic, where I'm very lucky to be alive. And I guess that was the straw that broke the camel's back, where I was lifted up by my neck, and I just thought that was the end. And then I looked at the kids, and I said, okay, that's it. And by then, that would have been my seventh restraining order in two different states. And so I decided, and unfortunately, it took me that many times to actually leave, which in itself, you kind of feel ashamed. How could I have let that happen for as long?
She finished her medical schooling and residency, keeping her eye on her goal.
I knew that I had to keep going to finish my degree so I could get out of the situation that I was in. That was my exit. So that's what pushed me every time I would be abused. It would give me internal fire to continue.
With a career and a way to pay the bills, she did leave. The result, her ex-husband stalked her even in the early years of her new marriage. However, she's not heard from him in 2 years, and she's not talked much about the situation till now.
Because I wanted to strip the stigma away from being a victim so more people would be forthcoming with their story to get help. A lot of people are ashamed of being a victim. I was too. For many years, and then I was afraid that people would think it would be my current husband, who is amazing and my knight in shining armor. My message is to those who are on the verge of possibly making a step, I encourage you to seek help and know that you are worth it. You are worth it. There's no excuse for being abused in any form, and you do not have to put up with it, and you should be treated like a princess.
And like the Disney princess Cinderella, Dr. Haridopoulos helps relieve the stress of her life by ballroom dancing. She got involved for a fundraiser and found she was good at it. Only when the clock strikes midnight, Haridopoulos doesn't have to run home. For Florida Public Radio, this is Jill Roberts.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. With permission from their school boards, a bill passed this session would give students the option of asking to lead prayer or deliver an inspirational message during school events. But Regan McCarthy reports the bill is expected to face legal challenges if it gets signed into law.
Harold Brockes worked as a Protestant minister in Pinellas County for 32 years and says he's active in his church still today. He's also the president of his county's chapter of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. And he says his group is already considering filing a lawsuit against the measure.
Students can now pray in school. We haven't taken prayer out of schools. What we've done is take the school out of prayer.
Brockes joined a group including a rabbi and a Baptist minister in writing a letter to Florida Governor Rick Scott asking him to veto the legislation. In the letter, they say religion shouldn't be forced on kids at school and certainly shouldn't be used to make minorities feel like outsiders.
And by the way, the separation of church and state is an American creation. It's like jazz, and it's one of the jewels in our crown, although it's not always been observed. But I hate to see it taken away from us.
Senator Ellen Bogdanoff talked about that outsider feeling during a debate on the measure earlier during this regular session.
I spent most of my life actually suppressing or hiding my religion just simply because it made me uncomfortable to be public about it, because I wasn't brought up in a community that was very accepting of people of the Jewish faith.
But Bogdanoff did vote for the proposal when it came to the Senate floor. The measure, which applies to students in kindergarten through 12th grade who go to public school, leaves it up to students to decide whether to deliver an inspirational message and what the content of that message should be. Senator Gary Siplin is the bill's sponsor. He says inspirational message can mean a number of things.
It is a part of prayer. Inspirational message can be the I Have a Dream speech by MLK because it inspires blacks and white. We need to work together and don't judge me by my skin color, but judge me by the character, my content of my character. And it could also mean when I sneeze, you say, God bless you. Or when I'm having lunch, we say, we bless the food. All those are a part of inspirational message. And of course, prayer is a part of inspiration message, too.
Siplin goes on to point out that school boards that do decide to implement the policy won't have to be concerned about lawsuits from organizations like Minister Brockes's.
This bill has been supported by all the best legal minds. It is constitutional. There is a statute that would allow the school boards to get attorney's fees. Once these opponents file lawsuits, they will lose because it is a frivolous lawsuit, and they will be able to get the school boards get the attorney's fees returned to them.
Siplin says the measure encourages students to hear prayers and messages from other views, and he says that would help to teach students about other beliefs and about tolerance as well as morality.
If we teach a kid how to read, write, and arithmetic, which is a part of the learning process and becoming a whole person, we ought to also teach them about morality and inspiration.
On the other hand, Brockes says he finds the idea of using prayer, which he says is about communicating with God, as a teaching tool, marginalizes the very thing it seeks to uphold. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tramel Gomes. Join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.